Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey everyone, it's Mary. Heading into the 2024 election, you are going to hear so much about hot button issues. You know the ones: guns, abortion, trans kids, parental rights. But you know what you're not going to hear? At least not enough. You're not going to hear from the people most affected by those issues. So all this week, we are spotlighting their stories. Today, you're going to hear from Greg Wickenkamp. He was a history teacher for years until Iowa banned teaching about divisive topics.
One student in particular, I remember, said, I heard we can't learn about Black people this year.
Over the last couple of years, elected officials have passed roughly 240 measures that restrict teaching about race in America. And Greg's story shows that push is not going away anytime soon. All right, here's the show. I called up Greg Wickenkamp to ask him to walk me through a very awkward Zoom call.
Hi, Dr. Noll.
Oh, you might be muted there, I think.
Greg was working as an eighth grade social studies teacher in Fairfield, Iowa, when he recorded this conversation. And the Zoom was with his boss, the superintendent, who he'd been trying to speak with for months.
But I was hoping to kind of run through some things that have been concerning me for some time and hopefully get some insights, if that works for you.
Greg was hoping to talk about this new law that he was struggling to comply with. One of those bills that bans the discussion of quote-unquote divisive content. Greg wanted the district to be clear about what divisive content was. He'd tried emailing the district. That had not worked. He thought that fit a pattern at his school.
Similarly, flippant and seemingly gaslighting responses are often made.
They were made in November. Going into this meeting, things were coming to a head for Greg personally. There had been complaints about how he taught. He used Ibram X. Kendi's anti-racist book, Stamped, from the beginning. The Indigenous People's History of the United States, too. So you wanted to meet with your superintendent just to be like, do you have my back here? Like, I'm using these books. Like, are we good?
Exactly.
What did you anticipate would happen at this meeting?
I was unsure.
For half an hour, Greg spars with his boss over the minutiae of how he is being treated. She says she doesn't want to make a big stink about defending him because she thinks that could inflame some families more. And then, with just a few minutes until this meeting is set to expire, Greg asks this question that it feels like he's been itching to get out.
You know, your stance and your support has sort of been to say, stick to the facts. Knowing that I should stick to the facts and knowing that to say slavery was wrong, that's not a fact. That's a stance. Is it acceptable for me to teach students that slavery was wrong?
I think it goes back to the part with critical race theory is that we can say this is what happened. And again, you probably know more about it than I do, Greg. And I think that's.
And it's so interesting to watch that moment because the superintendent kind of filibusters for a minute. I don't know if it felt like that to you in the moment.
No, absolutely. That's a great word. And it was fairly demoralizing.
To say, is slavery wrong? I really need to delve into it to see, is that part of what we can or cannot say? And I don't know that, Greg, because that's, I just don't have that.
This is when Greg's eyebrows shoot up and he puts his head in his hands.
Wow.
I'm sorry on that part.
You seem surprised by her response in the moment. Is that fair?
Yeah, I was somewhat surprised just because it was so blatantly sort of wishy-washy. You know, I thought surely this will be a question that can be answered.
In the affirmative. Yes, of course, teach slavery was wrong. That's in fact partly why young people need to study history, so we don't repeat mistakes of the past. And so I think it really shows how the political landscape has pushed schools and misshaped the potential for education.
I wanted to talk to Greg because we are in the middle of an ongoing fight about what we can and can't teach kids in American schools. The Florida legislature is considering a ban on discussing menstruation with elementary kids. And a teacher like Greg, he seems so gently reasonable, asking, what are we doing here and why? When you hung up the line, what did you do? Did you like have a drink?
I was sort of despondent. I immediately called a couple friends and you know, whoever would pick up the phone got to have an earful. And then when they had had enough, you know, I called the next friend. And I was sort of in shock. You know, teaching is something I've tried to dedicate my life to in many ways. Thankfully, I have a very wonderful network of support to which I was able to turn. Those folks all sort of said what I needed to hear. And that was like, you're not crazy. The situation is crazy. And it's disappointing and sad.
Today on the show, what can and can't be taught in school these days, and what happened when one teacher tried to find out. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than their worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members of FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
You taught eighth grade, right?
I did. In that district, I taught eighth grade social studies.
Why? Like, it's such a hard age. Kids are so, they're in this transition, right?
Right.
What did you like about teaching adolescents?
I really enjoy it, in part because you can have the sort of silly fun that you might have in an elementary school classroom, the play, learning through play, but then you can also start to go a little deeper in content. Students at that age are really developing their sense of self, and they're able to also look sort of at the world in more broad ways than they might have been as younger people. And so I really, really enjoyed working with students to try to help them think critically and broaden their sense of self and broaden what might be possible in the world and through their lives. And seeing the students learn at that age is really exciting.
Describe your school and community. Like, how big was the school and the community that it drew from?
Yeah, it's Fairfield is a very interesting community. It's a rural Iowa community. I saw roughly 100 students or a little less each year, but a really interesting and rich town with good restaurants for rural Iowa.
What did it mean to teach social studies there? Like, what kind of subjects were you covering in eighth grade?
Yeah, we covered the whole gamut: economics, geography, really history was kind of the major focus, but just social sciences generally. And really through that, my intention was to always inspire critical thinking and people who could then engage as citizens in a democracy, actively engage.
One of the books Greg thought did a good job of inspiring critical thinking was that Ibram X. Kendi book, Stamped, From the Beginning. It explores the history of racism in the U.S., but it also pops up with some regularity on anti-critical race theory book ban lists.
I think it's just a really remarkable book. And I think especially the youth adaptation by Jason Reynolds, I think is both provocative, but also deeply grounded in scholarship and also accessible for young people.
What did you want your students to take from it?
Yeah, I wanted them to start to think critically about race, which is often something, especially in Iowa and the Midwest, that people are hesitant to explore in any critical way.
Yeah, were they open to that?
Many students were. And many students, I think, especially after 2016 and then again after 2020, were sort of hungry for a deeper understanding because that was lacking generally in K-12 education for many students.
When the students weren't open to it, what did that look like?
You know, what was always interesting is oftentimes when I would start a unit or lesson, the first day students would be incredibly engaged. And then after perhaps visiting with their families or something, they might occasionally bring back these sort of biases against the particular content. So one student, for example, I can't remember if it was in that particular district or a prior one, we were reading an Indigenous People's History youth edition. And after a few days, he emailed me or talked to me and said, you know, I'm not going to read any more of this. It just doesn't jive with my opinion. I really believe that Blue Lives Matter and this text really is more of a Black Lives Matter thing. And that's not for me, which I thought was really strange and sort of a sad commentary on where we're at in society, because the text itself certainly addresses race and colonization and U.S. history, but it doesn't do so from a partisan way.
Yeah. Okay, so you were feeling these rumblings in the classroom. When did things shift in terms of what you were allowed to teach legally?
Yeah, that was in the summer of 2021. Iowa was one of the first amongst many states to pass these sort of anti-CRT laws.
As of July 1st, teachers won't be able to teach that the United States or the state of Iowa is fundamentally or systemically racist. They're also barred from race scapegoating and race stereotyping, and from creating discomfort or guilt because of one's race. Joining me now to discuss this.
And so that's when things really started to shift dramatically and pushback became even more emboldened. So I immediately sent a letter to the school board saying, hey, this law has passed. I'm really looking for support, as I have been for the last year, about what to teach and whether the district will support that. And so I outlined, you know, maybe five or so steps, that opportunities really that the district could take to sort of get ahead of any pushback that might result from the law.
So you're basically like, let's get ready for this.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Did you get any response when you sent that letter?
The response I got was curious. I got an email then from the superintendent who, it felt in the email to me like she was sort of admonishing me for going above her and not going directly to her. And then she sort of popped into my class early that fall while I was teaching, which I thought was odd.
Whoa.
And she said, hey, I just want you to know, just stick to the facts and you'll be fine, which didn't really address any of my concerns or the letter that I had written, but sort of set the path for the level of support that I received.
Huh. So she's like coming to you like, listen, just chill.
Right, right. Yes.
And you're like, that's not possible for me right now.
Right. Yeah. And it wasn't because I was confused about the law, which is very vague in Iowa, like many of these laws. And it wasn't because I was confused about what best teaching practices were. It was because I was concerned that the district wouldn't be supportive if tensions ramped up.
So I know this law, it passed over the summer. So I imagine you were planning your curriculum, getting ready to go back to the classroom. Once you got back to school, what was going on? Like, were other teachers talking about this law? Were the students?
Yeah, they were. In the fall, when I was sort of outlining the class for students, one student in particular, I remember, said, I heard we can't learn about Black people this year, which was really striking. Yeah, because the law is vague enough in Iowa that there's all these sort of misinterpretations, or maybe that's part of the purpose of the law, actually.
So what did you say to that student?
I said, well, we are learning U.S. history, so of course we will be learning about people of all races. And not only that, but we'll be explicitly exploring race since it is so central to U.S. history, past and present.
Did that calm the classroom down, or was there more murmuring after?
It did a little. I of course, was unsettled by that and emailed that. That was one of the many emails that I then sent off to administration saying, you know, here's what's going on in the classroom. Wanted you to be aware of it. Hopefully we can be a little more proactive in getting ahead of this.
Were your colleagues, other teachers, were they doing what you were doing? Sort of saying like, no, no, of course we're going to be talking about race. This is really important for you to learn as like a framework for understanding the country.
To varying degrees. There were some who really didn't want that level of pushback and so decided that they would just abandon any deep exploration of race, class, or gender. Others sort of said, well, I'll do this, but I'll sort of try to walk the fine line that doesn't draw more attention to myself from those who might want to unfairly impugn my practice.
At one point, a local state legislator singled you out at a public forum. And I don't think he used your name, but he identified you enough that it was clear who you were. He basically said, you were ignoring state law by using Ibram Kendi's Stamped from the Beginning in your social studies class. What happened there?
Yeah, that was very challenging. His appeal was really to sort of a QAnon type crowd. And so I was very wary of this politician already. And so when he started singling me out very publicly, that was incredibly worrisome. You know, he said in a public forum that what I was doing was indoctrinating students, teaching them to hate America, to hate white people. I was breaking the law. And this was all news to me. You know, I had not received any sort of direct pushback from the district or any politicians about my curriculum. And I would have welcomed a conversation. But it was clear that what he was doing was scapegoating my practice. And he was unrelenting about that.
Were people like telling you about these forums, like saying like, oh, I heard that guy again talking about you?
Yeah, it was really weighing heavily on me because I was already in a situation where I was unsure whether the district would be supportive. You know, while this was going on, we were being asked to misgender students and do things that I thought were harmful, that I know are harmful for students. And so I was already sort of trying to advocate for students in those ways. And so when I caught the public attention of this politician, it was scary. I remember the weekend after the first public forum, the union president called me and said she had heard about what had happened and said, you know, we're here for you. Keep protecting yourself, you know, lock your doors. And if things get too scary, don't hesitate to call 911. That was sort of the level of fear that I was having.
Yeah. This is all background for that meeting you eventually had with your superintendent, the one where she clearly is unclear about whether you can say slavery is wrong.
Right.
After that meeting, my understanding is that the district did try to support you a bit, but what happened there?
Yeah. Yeah, that was really interesting. Another school board member who happened to teach social studies in a neighboring district, he was sort of curious about how I was teaching and what I was teaching. And so we reviewed that. And sadly, his guidance was sort of that I should sort of both sides controversial events or give space to not just the North Union during the Civil War and the buildup to it, but space to the Confederacy. And not in a way that necessarily said, well, obviously the Confederacy was an error, but to say, well, some people thought this and other people thought that. And he applied this example also to the Holocaust, saying, you know, we want to share that many people believed the Holocaust was wrong, but you also want to say, here's why some German people embraced it. And so reflecting on that, I followed up with an email. I said, you know, these are eighth grade students. And that would be a real disservice to these young people. Of course, we want them to form their own judgments. And of course, we want to present a broad variety of perspectives. But to sort of imagine that we should or could be neutral on these issues like slavery or the Holocaust is really to the detriment of young people.
When we come back, how the fight over what can and can't be discussed in school expanded over the last year.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com. From the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking try free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
You quit your job at the end of the year last year.
Yeah, I didn't renew my contract. Yeah.
How did you come to that decision? You sound like you love teaching, like talking to you, like you're a teacher. You just are a teacher in how you speak.
Yeah, that was a really hard decision to walk away from K-12 and to recognize that perhaps Iowa is a challenging place to teach for justice or teach for critical thinking was really, really hard. You know, teaching is something that I thought long about before entering. And thought that that is what I would do until I retire in some way or another. And so to not renew my contract was really, really a hard thing.
Many proponents of laws restricting what's taught in schools, what they say is that children can't grapple with racism, that teaching white kids about racism will make them hate themselves, that teaching not white kids about racism will make them hate white kids or even feel bad about themselves as well. You taught kids for more than a decade. In your experience, was that true?
No, not at all. I mean, whether you're explicitly teaching about race or not, you're teaching about race because it's such a fundamental thing to the United States and the world. And so I think to remain silent on it just allows whatever prejudices are floating out there, namely white supremacy, to be adopted by many students to their detriment. Or there's, for example, the sort of doll test where students are asked to identify amongst a black and white doll, which is beautiful and which is good and which is bad. And these are like elementary students who are already reflecting sort of racial prejudices and white supremacy. And these tests have been repeated and repeated. And so I think, you know, if students are young enough to reflect the white supremacy of society, they're old enough to learn about it.
One of the most interesting things about those doll tests is that they found that black children also preferred the white doll.
Right.
And I think that's so important because part of what I think people misunderstand about an academic like Ibram Kendi is they frame his viewpoints as teaching that white people are bad because they have these beliefs about black people. When in reality, what he's teaching is that we all swim in a like racism soup and we're all absorbing these ideas. And so it impacts all of us. And it's like a subtle distinction, but so important.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Are we talking about white people or whiteness generally, you know, this sort of prejudice that attaches itself to race. And I think that because as a society, many of us don't fully understand that, people become defensive.
In the months since you left the classroom, politicians in Iowa have only widened their attacks on public schools in many different ways. In addition to race, there's now a lot of talk about gender and sexuality. Your governor gave this speech where she was sort of characterizing people opposed to her administration. She's a quite conservative Republican. The way she put it was, you know, they think patriotism is racist and pornographic library books are education.
They believe that the content of our character is less important than the color of our skin. They believe children should be encouraged to pick their gender. And for the parents, well, they're just in the way. Well,
I wonder how you hear something like that, because it sounds like what you started seeing in 2020, it's only kind of metastasizing.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's only growing, and it's scary and it's sad, I think. And I think it reflects this sort of narrow view of what the U.S. is and can be, and this narrow view of patriotism. And so I think if we really want to live to our highest ideals, we owe it to students to teach them to think critically about these things.
Yeah. I mean, in the years since you left the classroom, Iowa legislators have banned gender-affirming care for trans youth. The House has passed a bill that would prohibit the teaching of sexual orientation and gender identity in kindergarten through sixth grade. There's a bill that limits bathroom use in schools to quote-unquote biological sex. There's curriculum measures that remove the requirement to teach students about HIV, and that's just awaiting the governor's signature. If you were back in the classroom now, would you be able to have the kind of open conversations you want to have with kids?
That's a really great question. I don't know. I think it would depend on the district, how supportive they were of all the students, how they interpreted these laws. And I think we're approaching a time when supporting students in these ways is becoming illegal. And I know people with trans kids who are considering leaving the state just because of that, because they want their students to grow up in a safe and supportive environment, which Iowa is becoming less and less.
Yeah, I wonder if you think about your state differently now. And I ask that because I think people may have forgotten that Iowa was like the third state to legalize same-sex marriage.
Yeah.
It was the state Supreme Court that did it, not the legislature. And this was 2009.
Right. Sure. No, Iowa has a longer tradition of really progressive, inclusive politics going way back. And so I think that this recent turn is a dangerous direction for Iowans in a lot of ways. We're seeing it reflected in a variety of ways, like the brain drain is talked about a lot. There was a Iowa State professor who just shared that in his 20 or 25 years of teaching, he would often ask his senior economics students how many plan to stay in Iowa, and it was always relatively few. And I think that's really sad, especially because Iowa has long been known for having great schools and education, and now we are not. I'm actually having lunch today with a colleague who quit after death threats and another who felt sort of forced out for advocating around issues of diversity for students. And so,
oh my gosh.
Yeah, I think there are a number of teachers who are firmly committed and able to carry on in the classroom and do really good and thoughtful work. And I also know handfuls of teachers who have not been able to continue to do that.
Greg, thanks for taking the time to talk to me. I'm really grateful.
Yeah, thank you.
Greg Wickenkamp is a PhD student at the University of Iowa. Until last year, he was an eighth grade social studies teacher for the Fairfield Community School District in rural Iowa. And that's our show. If you're a fan of what we're doing here at What Next, the best way to show us some love is to join Slate Plus, which is our membership program. To find out more, go on over to slate.com/whatnextplus. You can sign up right there. What Next is produced by Elena Schwartz, Anna Phillips, Paige Osborne, and Madeline Ducharme. We are getting a ton of help these days from Laura Spencer. We are led by Alicia Montgomery, with a little help from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary Harris. Go track me down on Twitter. I'm at Mary's Desk. All right. Thanks for listening. Catch you back here tomorrow.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.